Welcome, mountain bikers. You're listening to Vital MTB's The Inside Line. And this week, we had a special opportunity to meet up with Judd Duvall of Alpine Bike Parks. I've known Judd for a while, back in the Colorado downhill days, and was excited to get back in touch with him as he was in Boise working on a bike park project with the city. He was able to stop by and we caught up about old times, his transition from bike racer to bike park builder, what it takes to get a public bike park in your city, the impact that IMBA has on trail building right now, as well as kind of the future of where things are going. Hope you enjoy the episode and stay tuned to Vital MTB for Red Bull Rampage content all week. This Vital MTB Inside Line podcast is brought to you by Jensen USA. Shop for great deals and get professional advice on your favorite mountain bikes, components, and riding gear. Over 2 million happy cyclists served since 1994. Visit JensenUSA.com/TheInsideLinePodcast and use code INSIDELINE for 10% off qualifying items. Maxxis Tires. Where the rubber meets the dirt, Maxxis makes no compromise tires for any rider, any trail, any time.
We got a fun way to get the levels going. So, all right. So I asked Moga, Maddie, all those dudes, like, "Hey, I'm going to talk to Judd. Anything you want to talk about?" Moga wants to know, and we'll use this to kick off to check some levels. Moga wants to know if you remember him trying to fight you for no apparent reason at West Virginia, the post race party, and he's blaming alcohol and the sausage fest on his raise, on his rage. So I got to say, I'd put my money on Moga. Or I mean on you, so no offense, Boga. Do you remember that at all?
Oh, yeah, I totally remember that. And, yeah, West Virginia. And so I don't remember how it started, but I know how it ended. And it was with Ross Milan body slamming me into the asphalt. And so,
are you serious? Like it got taken that far?
Well, no, it didn't go far at all. It was just that Ross put an end to it. So that's what I, that was,
like,
that,
did that's think it was legit. Like what happened? That's crazy.
I'm not sure. I mean, but it certainly wasn't, I mean, I don't know. I had a really good finals run that year and the tree took a lot out of me that I hit like on the last straight. So yeah, compared to that, it was nothing. So yeah. But I really missed those days racing and you know, some of my best relationships ever have come out of racing bikes, and I kind of owe everything I have to racing bikes, really, because that's where I met my wife and you know, everybody else that really I stay in touch with. So, yeah, great memories.
Okay. That's crazy. It's so funny. Just think about that. Like Moga trying to pick on you. He's like, "Oh, I'm pretty sure I was wasted and
yeah,
it was just a sausage fest." And
yeah, man, racing downhill in the early 2000s. Yeah.
Yep. Cool. All right. Well, I'll kick off an intro and we'll get going, make it official. But welcome to Vital MTB's The Inside Line podcast. I'm Sean Spomer. And today our special guest is Judd Duvall. Is it Duvall? Duvall? How do you say it?
I say Duvall.
Duvall. Okay, good. Owner of Alpine Bike Parks, is that the right title? Yeah. And a chiseled human specimen, no doubt right there. Thanks for being on the show, dude. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for asking me some questions. It's nice to think that that you'd like to have me on.
Heck yeah, dude. How's your little Idaho trip going? Tell us a little bit about why you're out this way.
Idaho's good. Our company is working with the J.A. and Catherine Albertson Family Foundation to help develop a new bike park here in Boise. And it's been a long summer with many meetings, and we're looking forward to getting started with construction.
Cool. Well, we'll get into what you're doing right now, but we typically start off with some history, where you're from, how you got into bikes. Kind of tell us a story about how we are here right now with you doing what you're doing. So,
well, I guess, I grew up in Mendocino, California. It's a little town on the North Coast, out a mile long dirt road in the middle of the Redwoods. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, my first little jump that I built is still out there. And when I take my kids home, they're able to go ride the little hits that we built when we were little kids. But I was just like,
"Are you serious?"
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, Yeah, so we, in fact, there's a whole, like, you know, we were able to ride dirt bikes and BMX bikes right out the back door when I was little.
Okay.
And there was thousands and thousands of acres. So mostly we were riding dirt bikes, but we did have, I mean, I had a BMX bike just like most everybody else in that era. And mountain biking wasn't really, I mean, I guess I'm old enough where it's like, there weren't mountain bikes when I was little. So, anyway, long story short, rode a bunch of bikes, especially moto when I was a kid, and then went to the University of Colorado. And that's where I got into, I guess it's funny. It's like, I couldn't ride my dirt bike because I was living in Boulder and everything shut down. And so I started riding trials because I could study
trials bicycles.
So basically I'd be able to study all day, and then at night or whenever I could go out, bang out a bunch of stuff on campus. And, and then that got really slow. And so I got into riding downhill, and, there was an amazing scene in Boulder at the time, Jody Stoddard, all the guys from, Big Crank. And so, yeah, there's a really strong shuttle scene, and worked my way into that.
I think I met you up at Gold Hill. That's probably the first time. I don't even remember.
Really. I was going to ask you when it was that we met, but yeah.
I assumed it was on one of those days, or just like a Mountain States Cup. But
yeah, it's funny. I was definitely like an outsider at the start, but my girlfriend at the time was living in a little cabin near there, and so I was out building pretty substantial jumps on other people's trails, and it was
there's a jump called Judd's.
It was this very private trail system where people weren't supposed to really go there and build unless you had permission. And so, yeah, at first there was a bit of angst or conflict, but it was fun to get through it all. And, those trails were amazing. Super, super technical, and they made a lot of really good riders because there was very little room for error, and there was such a strong scene that, you know, it was just trains of people down really nice, steep, technical trails, some big jumps built into them, and probably 3-minute laps. So it was really good for then transitioning into downhill racing.
Okay. What took you to Boulder? I mean, obviously school, but like why CU versus staying in California and all that?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to go to Santa Barbara, and there was a little glitch in my application. I ended up not getting accepted to Santa Barbara at first. Okay. And then I was accepted at CU. So they had a good business school. I went and got a couple degrees, but primarily from the business school there.
Okay.
And, I kind of wonder how it would have worked out if I'd gone to UC Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Huh. Interesting. Did you have any kind of goals in mind when you went to school for business, or was it just kind of like, go for business and that's just sort of what you do?
No. Yeah, it was definitely, I'm going to go trade derivatives on Wall Street and we're going to trade commodities. I'm going to make what I need to make, and then I'm going to quit and I'm going to go buy a cabin in the mountains, and that's what I'm going to do.
Seriously.
And so, yeah, it was interesting. I got an internship at university probably junior, senior year. And so I'm working with some investment salespeople, and I really had a change of heart on what I wanted to do with my time. So, coming out of that internship, and it was interesting. It was like, basically my role was to help sell securities to people.
Okay.
And we were selling securities that were in our prioritization of which securities we were selling or being directed to sell was 100% based on the commission. Mm-hmm. It was not what was best for the client. It was not. And so I guess I just really had a change of heart about who I wanted to work with, and that changed my direction quite a bit.
Interesting. Dude, how does a kid from Mendocino, like just kind of assume like hippie land, and you're out in the woods, like how do you get to this point of like, I'm going to do the Wall Street thing so I can make money and bone out?
Well, I guess, you know, my dad always made an effort to bring me into the city when I was younger. And so we had, he'd taken me to New York City a number of times. We had family on the East Coast. There was more going on than, I mean, yeah, they were definitely beatniks, and I was raised basically as an old commune where I grew up.
Wow, really?
And the commune had failed.
Okay.
And so I actually came out of that with a very sort of biased view on some not-for-profit efforts where I actually felt that community-driven sort of bootstrap projects are not necessarily the best way to achieve something. And so I'm stuck between worlds where, very much I grew up as a liberal West Coast kid. And at the same time, I do think that capitalism works. So, it's funny.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay. So, did you kind of get the love for trail building just because you had to do it at home if you wanted stuff to ride, like when you were a kid? So, all right, you're going out to Gold Hill and building jumps. Like, where did you learn to start building stuff?
Well, I guess there's a couple things there. How do you learn to do it? And, I think success is based on experience, and experience is a collection of failures. And so, you go out, you experiment, you learn, you work with good people. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But, over time, the more good people you can work with, the more you can learn and the better you can do at creating something.
Okay, but like when you were a kid, like, hey, I want to jump something. I guess I have to build it. Don't think every kid's like that.
Well, I was an only child growing up in the woods, right? So it was just me and my shovel and my bike. There was no other, like parties to building a jump. Okay. That was it. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So you have a change of heart with what you want to do in school.
Right.
Or with, with life and career. So where do you go from there? And is this kind of when downhilling's happening? And
downhilling's definitely, so this is the late 90s, early 2000s. And I ended up meeting a woman who's now my wife. And I was totally shocked that someone could be a professional athlete, because I grew up, reading BMX Action or whatever magazines we were reading. And these guys, you just hold them on a pedestal.
Sure.
That they grew up in some other type of experience. And so I met Chrissy, and I asked her what she did. And she's like, oh, I'm a professional athlete. Yeah, I ride for Saab Gary Fisher. And I thought to myself, hold on, I want to do that. I actually hadn't raced downhill yet at that point.
Okay.
But then basically she's like, well, you can totally do it if you want. You just got to put your mind to it. Mm-hmm. And so I went out, at the time I was working for the International Mountain Bicycling Association, and I have a lot of conflicts with that now, thinking back about that. Okay. And I have,
we'll talk,
and we can talk about that. It's a different story, but I was in Italy, and we were doing a bit of a summit there to help things get going in Finale Liguri, which is a great place to ride.
Yeah.
And so I went with this guy, Bruno Zonchi, to go race this downhill race at San Remo.
Okay.
And that was my very first race. And I didn't have a license or anything, but they got me a pre-runner plate. And so I did this race. It's funny. Fabian Burrell was there, like racing for GT, like super old school.
Bruno's on Santa Cruz, wasn't he? At least Matt Thompson always had a Bruno Zonchi poster that was, he was on like the beer can super.
Right.
I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So we were kind of friends with the importer there for Italy. So, anyway, I went to this race and I was like, whoa, that was pretty sweet. Like my time is pretty good. I'm not on the official results list, but it was a good time.
Yeah.
And then from there, just started jumping into some more races, and let's see, we were basically doing, was it the Mountain States Cup then, or was it even before Mountain States? It was like Corpse Series or something.
Maybe I didn't
old school
around till
Mountain States Cup. So did some of those races. Times were pretty good. Decided to, and then we were doing all the Norman Nationals. And so basically the first year I was able to get up to semi-pro or pro, I think. And then
it was pretty heavy in those days. Like those were big lists of riders.
It's funny. It's like they were really gnarly. Like, yeah, there were some guys out there then that are still out there. Like, I remember when Mick Hanna and Kavarik first came over to Big Bear, and like Mick showed up with, his like Captain America helmet on. We were all like, whoa, who is this guy? And it was, it was the days just slightly after Sean Palmer, Nicholas Villoz was still killing it. You know, you had EC, you had Dave Cullinan was still in the game at that point. You had, Lopes was very strong, Boots, you know, yeah, there's a lot of guys on the domestic scene that were very strong. You had a bunch of Australians coming in, and some Euros coming over. And yeah, it was right around the time after we had the World Cup at Squaw Valley where I started getting more into racing bikes. Okay. And yeah, the transcontinental era, I think could say.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Yeah, so anyway, went up to Canada to race a Canada Cup to get a UCI point. And so basically during that first year, I was able to go through the classes, get my pro license, and then go get a UCI point. And then I was able to go hit some of the World Cups in Europe. I think Léger was the first World Cup that I rode in, and I think I qualified. I don't know. We should go to Elliott's site and see what, see what I qualified. But, yeah, it was a great experience. And it's, you know, the thing about racing the World Cup tracks that was so beautiful is the lines that the top 80 guys in the world create are different than any other trail you'll ever ride because there's no one out there jackknifing the turns. And so you could create a level of flow on a World Cup track that you can't create anywhere else.
Okay.
And
does that come down to the skill and knowledge of the rider basically?
Well, I think they're just, you know, you're kind of no breaking in and just shifting your body weight and just pressing through your little traction point and then popping out of the turn. And, and yeah, it's about, you know, everybody's just entering a little bit wider or cutting it a little bit closer or just slightly more off in the grass. Right. So yeah, I love the technical, challenge of racing downhill, especially out on the World Cup. I didn't really get that far or get that many races under me at that level, but at some point my anxiety of getting hurt was just way less fun than the best day competing at that level.
Okay.
And so it's like, it didn't make sense. It's funny. I was like seventh in the US after national championships 1 year. I think we'd have to look at it, but then the next year, basically, and I broke my wrist racing moto and I didn't want to go to Sea Otter because my wrist was kind of broken. And then basically I just never came back to racing after that.
Really? So there's kind of that practical sensibility in your head that like you could weigh the risk versus reward and
maybe, yeah. I don't know if it's practical. I mean, it may be more practical to be able to shut it off, you know, I think compartmentalizing things and being able to focus 100% on something is beautiful. It's, I wish that I had had a higher threshold that the mental game of it is the difference. It is being able to, no matter what you're doing, whether you're racing downhill or you're making an investment that is risky, but you're going to go for it. Like you have to be able to bury those doubts and complications and that stuff. It's that stuff's got to get, you can't be thinking about that if you're going to win. So yeah. I don't know, I guess that's my perspective on it. Sure. I wish that I'd been able to handle it better, but yeah, there were some crashes that were just, you know, like separated sternum, broken ribs, broken clavicle, torn rotator cuff, like, you know, stuff that, and like, I look at other people coming back and it's like, wow, I'm amazed and impressed. And like, it's such to see people come back from injury and work through it and rebalance their body. Like my shoulders haven't worked right since Fort William, you know, 2002. So, so it's like, I mean, I love seeing people put the commitment in to, to both bury the risk and also to train their body to come back from injury is huge.
So. Okay. What year was that? Do you remember?
I think it was 2002.
Okay. Like, and so the Sea Otter thing, you're like, eh.
Oh, that would have been 2005.
Okay.
Would have been, yeah. So basically I raced from 2000, 2004. I
think. Okay. Had you been like, what were you doing to earn a living then?
You know, a lot of it, I was just putting on credit cards. Like,
really?
So yeah, I got a job. So I was living at Miles Rockwell's house in Durango. And this was after he had retired. And then I got a job working with Hyundai Mongoose. And so for like the majority of this time, I was just helping to drive cars, set up pits, just kind of being the schlep around the pit. So mm-hmm. we had EC on Hyundai Mongoose with Brian Smith, Todd Wells, those guys. And then we had Lopes on Hyundai GT. But we all kind of – so Stick was Lopes' mechanic, and Hatfield was EC's mechanic.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we just kind of – I mean, it was us traveling together. They gave me – you know, they covered my travel.
Okay.
And, so,
but you had a connection. It's not like you
yeah.
were – okay.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so, yeah, and so that's – that those were definitely as far as being able to get around mm-hmm. and – make it around the whole circuit without going into too much debt. That was the best program that okay. I was on.
Yeah. yeah. So, okay. You decide racing's not the jam anymore. When did it start turning into building trails, or kind of where were you next after that?
Right. So my wife, fortunately, was much more successful than I was in racing. And so we both kind of, she retired mm-hmm. and I sort of quit. And so then we were figuring out what do we want to do next? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I guess,
like, was a 9-to-5 an option for you? Or you're just like, I don't want to do a 9-to-5. Like, I want to do anything but that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It was more like contract work where I'd go to work for a few months. And so one of our first projects was right at the end of the season. I think it was after Schweitzer or something. And so we got a job developing Tamarack Resort, which is...
like doing trail building.
Yep.
Okay.
So, and so I was on the first round of guys building at Tamarack. And
do you remember how that happened? Like how you got connected?
Yeah, that was... well, so this was like reconnecting with IMBA.
Okay.
And I had a close friend there, Joey Klein, who was there. That organization has changed so much over the years. When I was first working for them, we had one trail care crew, and Joey and Kathy were the second trail care crew that came on. I mean, they've probably had 40 or 80 or something at this point, who knows? So I asked Joey if they had any work, and he's like, yeah, you can come down here and design and build this park. Huh. It was funny. So that first fall, yeah. So they gave me like, basically I show up and there is a clear cut that's been graded and all the slash has been caught on fire. And basically they're like, all right, here is a burning dirt slash pile, build what you want with it. And I was just like, and so, yeah, it was a really interesting, it was like, how do you make something out of this where it's your first project and you're going to have successes and failures,
sure.
Lots of learning experiences. And you have this very formal construction site, run by Washington Group, and you have materials that are not productive whatsoever. And so, you know, it's kind of in that era, they would send one person out to run something and they'd let you choose your local contractors. And so I ended up with one guy who, you know, I think he was the greatest guy ever. He's a construction cowboy.
Uh-huh.
And I think he delivered pizzas. He was probably in his 60s. He delivered pizzas and apparently he operated equipment. And so this guy, you know, like he did his best, but we didn't have the right people with the right skill set and the yeah. right balance to bring it all together. And yep. so at the end of this thing, I'm like, are you gonna promote this thing or anything? Like, what is your plan? And they're like, what do you think we should do? I was like, well, we should get let's get Ian Highlands out here and we'll get Matt
Matt Collins. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. So we had Ian Highlands. We had Matt Collins, who I called somebody and they were like, or no, Matt said, yeah, there's these two cams. Like there's, and I don't know which one it is, but I think he's from Santa Cruz. And so Cam McCall shows up.
Yep.
with a blown out Ellsworth with like pedals falling off the spindles. And he's like this young kid. And
did Kurt go on that one too?
I wonder.
Because I know he filmed there for like a New World part, but.
Yeah, funny. I wonder if Kurt was there. So I think we had Aaron Peters. Had Cam. There would have been a few other guys.
Sure.
But anyway, it was mildly successful. And
so anyway, that's. Got some press, right?
Like, well, it's great to be able to think back to when Cam was a Grom.
Yeah.
And now he's like, you know, more in the Godfather sort of like level. So it's pretty cool.
So is that that was kind of your first foray into you running a project, making it happen? And was it crickets after that? Did you have more? Did people see the success? And like, how did you keep finding work? And
so,
keep going?
Yeah, we did. So this was as an employee for IMBA.
Okay.
And, so during this era, there was very little kind of understanding from their organizational perspective on what it takes to build a fun place to ride.
Okay.
Even though that might seem odd, it's like they didn't have a formula for that. So then, you know, in essence, I was trying to help them build a team so that instead of just having one person that manages volunteers, we would have a few people that would actually do the work. Mm. And it's so important to have strong people with good leadership, good communication and experience to do a lot of the work. Like the Olympics is, you know, the biggest volunteer event ever, but there's a lot of people behind the Olympics that get stuff done.
Yeah.
And so on all these little projects, so they kept, you know, we did one here in Boise as well during that same era. They'd spend me in, we'd have 3 days to build a set of dirt jumps with donated equipment that's all wrong. Mm. And it became really challenging and frustrating to sort of have the same experience over and over again. Yeah. And then it's funny, during that period, we were doing a lot of work in Idaho for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't know why exactly that came to be, but there's a number of projects in Idaho. One up in Haley, which is in the Wood River Valley, just near Sun Valley. Yeah. And Ketchum. And I was able to get Randy Spangler in to help run equipment on that project. And that was the first project where we actually had someone that enjoyed running equipment, that enjoyed riding bikes, that knew how to build and test something that was fun. Hmm. And we were still in the circumstance, though, where basically this thing had been underbid and you end up getting it to 60% and they say you're cut off, you don't have any more hours. Mm. And so then you kind of, you turn around and you're like, gosh, like we're not really getting this done. Like we have too many limitations around how we can get this work done. Right.
Yeah. And it wasn't anything where you could be like, well, we want to stay here and finish it. It was just, I imagine the cost was too prohibitive.
Well, you know, when you're working for an hourly rate, I mean, you're trying to make ends meet, right? Like I feed my family from bikes. And at that point I was trying to pay off credit cards from racing with bikes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're in a place where you're trying to get the collections department to stop calling you for your credit card. And it's like, you just got to go to work. You know, you're not like, I mean, I want to make the world a better place. It's a huge part of why I do what I do. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there's, you know, in order to do that, you have to be in the black.
Yeah, for sure. So was this a project, and this was with IMBA, this one, Haley. Was this the one where you are kind of like, we got to do this on our own?
Well, yeah, at some point it became clear that I had a different sort of philosophy and I wanted to do things a little bit differently, and they were very gracious with that. Hmm. And so at that point in time, I was managing a few different projects that were all in the design phase. And so I asked if I could take those projects from IMBA do them on my own with my new company. And then I would also subcontract back to IMBA.
Okay.
And yeah, they were amazingly gracious with that. You know, there was also wage equity issues where I needed to be paid more, and they were saying we can pay you more, but only if you're a contractor, not if you're an employee, because we have different people at the same level and we need to keep everybody on the same level.
Okay.
And I totally appreciate that as a manager, as a human resource manager.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important part of doing things
yep.
Well and keeping your people happy. So,
for sure.
Yeah. So then I was able to take those projects and run them independently. One of them was the Eagle Bike Park here. Dude,
which is sick. I didn't realize that you were behind it. And then it's, how old is it? 10 years old, 12 years old.
So that was the first project that we did as Alpine Bike Park. So okay. Alpine Bike Parks was founded in Boise, Idaho in December of 2007.
Okay.
And we started the Eagle Bike Park in 2008.
Okay.
And they said, it never snows in Boise. And, and we got so much snow. We tried to start too early. And so we had Eric Carter and Randy Spangler and myself out here. And yeah, we called it frog guts because there's a layer of probably 4 to 6 inches of hard pack on top, but there's a giant aquifer underneath, and your machine would go through that layer and it would just start sinking.
Oh, really?
And, so amazing dirt. It's good to have the experience now that, uh-huh. that we didn't have then. Yeah. And, I think, you know, everybody is really happy with, how the Eagle Bike Park has made Eagle has enhanced quality of life for people in Eagle and for all around the Treasure Valley. It's a really, there's a lot of cross country trails here
yep.
that the Ridge to Rivers Trail system have developed, and there are very few opportunities to go catch air or throw a big roost or push yourself technically.
Yep.
And so it's gone through a number of different phases, and overall, it's been really positive.
Yeah, it's so fun. I'm blown away to see, like, I don't know if I told the story in the one with Kyle Warner, but rolled up on like a Tuesday at 9 a.m. I'm like, all right, I'll take my kids to the pump track real quick. And like, no one will be here. There's like a parks and rec class of like 30 kids on bikes cruising around. And there's always just these huge bike driven things going on there. And I'd never seen anything like that before in person. It's super sick to see. Like just what it's done to the community here. And so, you know, a side note for people not living in Eagle, but yeah, it's sick to see what it brings to the town. That's the reason we chose this particular area too. So it's because of that park. Like it's down the street. Let's go.
Generally every community we work with, not everything is about real estate values, but one of the great things about these projects is that inherently real estate values around these facilities go up.
Mm-hmm.
That improves the tax base for the local government, which in turn allows them to provide better programs and better facilities maintenance. And at the same time, you can also have revenue generation from programming like what you saw or events mm-hmm. or other types of revenue generation from these bike parks. For me, you know, I was never like in high school, I wasn't a team sports guy. And so I think it's really important to be providing opportunities for youth, especially at-risk youth. And I kind of see everyone as at risk in some way. We've got to make sure that there's places where they can learn to have fun, be free, communicate and socialize with other people.
Kind of take ownership of something.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think about it as learning to take risks and judge risks. And so in many ways we have insulated people from risk, and then you learn about risk when you crash your car. And so I think that because people are so insulated until they get into an extremely high risk situation, they don't really know how to manage their levels on that. And so I like the idea it's very challenging for me as a dad. I see my kids growing up in a very risk-based environment. Yeah. And
Judd lives in Whistler. We're going to hear a story about his kids here at the end of the podcast, but go ahead.
So it's tough to watch them test themselves and become hurt, but I think that in the end, it's teaching them really valuable lessons, and it may save them from something much worse. I mean, you know, as we get older, we see so many people succumb to accidents that have nothing to do with riding bikes. So,
yeah, interesting. So, with the work you did here, was it just kind of on? You're like, hey, this is a full time gig, like let's go, or did it ebb and flow? Like, how did the success work out?
It's always a roller coaster. And yeah, it is. So at first, you know, the first year we did quite well, between this park. And then we did work with a couple of years with Seven Springs Resort in Pennsylvania. And we were bouncing back and forth between the two, learning how to manage multiple projects at the same time. And yeah, it's, designing and building mountain bike parks is a challenging business proposition. Work is really, you know, you're drinking from fire hose 1 second and then you're in a desert the next second. Yeah. And you have to learn how to ride that out. And the toughest part is learning to enjoy the time when you don't have work and really realize that there will be work and you just gotta enjoy those moments. That's your break time.
Yeah.
And any moment you can get a break is so nice. If you can enjoy it, if you're always worried about, oh, I gotta go get another gig, then it's a stressful
downtime situation. It sounds like torture.
Yeah.
Kind of jumping back here a little bit, but what kind of bike park precedent was there when you started building, like when Eagle came out? Because it kind of seems, or mid-2000s, late-2000s, I guess.
Post office.
That was it.
Well, I mean, that's not really a bike park, but yeah. I mean, post office and the culture around post office, and I'm very much a spectator at that. We ended up hiring a number of guys from that community. Mm-hmm. But, what would the best example of bike park been? I mean, gosh, Colonnade,
how did Eagle or wherever one of these first projects was, how did they get pitched? Like, this is a good idea. You need this.
Well, Eagle. So many of these are somewhat of a public private partnership. So the Idaho Velodrome and Cycling Park Association was a nonprofit that was founded to fund and manage this project.
Okay.
The finances of that agreement with the city of Eagle and Ada County were very challenging. That organization went bankrupt mid-construction. Ugh. And everything was turned over to the city of Eagle or to the county. It was not... just if we were to use an example mm-hmm. of a park as a smooth sort of model, it would not be Eagle.
Okay.
Or we would focus on certain aspects of it
sure.
that are good. So I guess to take a step back, maybe without going into that level of detail,
yeah.
there was a nonprofit group that brought this idea to the community. They had great contacts with professional athletes like Kristen Armstrong and fundraisers. And it was, you know, 2007 going into 2008. It was before the financial crash, and everyone had very strong prospects for where the market was going.
Sure.
So they were able to basically gather the community, get the signatures, bring the idea at a high level to the council and to mayor and say, this is what we should do to make Eagle happen.
Okay. So it was a community driven effort.
Yeah.
That
yep.
worked its way
yeah.
through the process civically, and then you could get involved.
Yeah. And that's the same way in many ways that the park, the facility we're working on with the Albertson Family Foundation is happening right now as well.
Yeah. So yeah, one of the questions I have is, you know, if I'm Joe mountain biker in a town with not much, but I know there could be something there, like where do I start on a process like this as a local citizen who wants a bike park?
Well, certainly your first step is communication with other people. And then we are all mountain bikers, but we all do something else. And so you need to get a leadership group together of mountain bikers that also are leaders in other realms within their life. So you may have someone that is on council. You may have someone that is working in financial management. You may have someone that is working in communications, or, and really it's how do you leverage the 3 degrees of separation in order to build a team. Generally, anytime you're building something, you're going to need an accountant, a lawyer, a visionary, a communications person, a graphic designer. And with that team, you can start fundraising, you can start spreading the word, you can start creating this sort of nucleus. And then you gather those signatures, you paint that picture of what you want to create. And then someone needs to know, either mayor or council or county CEO or some other leader in your agency having jurisdiction. So like with the city of Boise, we have a number of agencies having jurisdiction over that project.
It's not just like, hey, I want a bike park. I'm going to go to the city council by myself and say, we need a bike park.
Yeah, it's building your team.
Okay.
That's the key. Yep. Is finding people that have influence and good relationships. Okay. And bringing them together.
Cool. Let me go turn off the heater.
Smart.
It's all right. What do you find a typical hurdle would be for a project getting off the ground, whether it's like to the point of you being contracted already or even just, you know, getting a city's ear?
The toughest part is proving the need and getting the funding. And on some projects with more traditional leadership, they really don't believe that people want a mountain bike facility. Or they feel that it is a special use for a very small group of people. And that's difficult for us to fathom, but it's really important to learn how to communicate that mountain biking or riding bikes in general is something that we all share. Mm-hmm. It's not for a specific type of person. It's a way to bring people together. Secondly, fundraising, especially for groups without what we call a fiduciary agent, which is generally a nonprofit that allocates funding for a project, is really tough.
Okay.
And so learning how to create strategic partnerships between the community group that's interested in creating this and the foundations that work in your region is a really important part of making the project successful. There are a number of grants out in everywhere that anyone lives. There are grants that can be drawn on to fund projects. There is generally quite a bit of competition for those grants. But it is the grant writing skill set that is missing from many of these small groups. And so
is that kind of like the pitch to the people providing the grant?
Yeah. So a grant writer would know what grants are available. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, you might have a federal level grant that's across all, you know, 50 states, or all the provinces of Canada. You might have local grants, you might have foundations. There's all these different levels that they can reach up to. Often, you know, the biggest thing is people don't have a big enough dream. Mm-hmm. That the greatest challenge is that they only reach to this first level grant for like $5,000 or $10,000. Like, no, go ask for $2 million. Mm-hmm. Like you can't, it is really challenging. If you don't have a clear enough, long range enough vision, you're not going to get there. Mm-hmm. And so when you try and do it little steps at a time, some of the,
it's actually harder.
It's really hard.
Huh. Interesting.
So one of the, I mean, the timeline, you know, for us as a small company, you could refer to it as a purchasing process or timeline. And I might meet someone at a trade show this year. They bring that back. They bring that idea of a bike park back to staff meeting next year. Then somebody writes a proposal about allocating funding, which might get in front of council next year, but it might not get in front of council for a year or so. Jeez. So at this point, we're basically 2 years into the process and we haven't even gotten this thing approved by council to go after funding for it yet. Mm-hmm. And so that process may be happening simultaneous to your group's process where you're out bringing people together, looking at sites you're interested in, and going out and finding funding. And if you can get initial funds for feasibility study, site selection study, design, planning, all of that, you're going to be able to really accelerate the process. But generally, it very easily could be a 5-year process just to get to a bid mm-hmm. for design or design build. Mm-hmm. And then with the city of San Francisco, they had already started their process. We started working with the nonprofit group there in 2011.
This is from McLaren?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That park then got split into multiple phases, and they only got their first dirt pump track built last year.
Yeah.
Like, and so it took 7 years to get it just through planning, design, and to get a pump track built. And
it's not big.
Like, no, it's small. Yeah. And the whole rest of that park is maybe another 5 to 10 to 15 years away for like all the cool stuff. And so if there had been a foundation that were part of that and they were able to sign a development agreement with the city for a gift in place strategy, then you know the Google Foundation or some other foundation in the Bay Area is looking for good projects.
Sure.
So really, there are many ways to do this. I think that the public tendering route is a very challenging one. At the end of the day, it always goes to the lowest bidder anyway. So you're not guaranteed to have the right people building it. Hmm. And so I think that communities finding ways to bring cyclists together from all walks of life, show that diversity that's within our community, join with a financial foundation that wants to improve community quality of life, and then take that, have a big vision, and then join together to gift that vision in place to the municipality is the best way to achieve change.
That's interesting. When this all started, and I guess you were with IMBA, so you were kind of in touch with all this, but did you think that you would be so in tune and almost like so deep in this kind of process? Like, you're not slinging dirt. Like,
no.
Most of the time it sounds like you just said, yep. You said you're pushing papers, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I, that's interesting. I don't think I had any expectations of what it was going to turn into. I just really hoped that I kept loving riding bikes, because a lot of people get pretty far off into just building trails when they do it for a living, and they lose sight of why we're building trails. And so my main thing was I just want to keep getting fulfillment out of riding bikes. As long as I'm doing that, and especially with my family at this point, yeah. That's definitely a higher priority. You know, how we make projects successful. I'll do anything that I need to do to keep things positive and to get the right outcome. And I mean that in the most positive way. If it's sitting in front of my computer for 10 hours, or if it's giving the job to somebody else, or if it's digging in the dirt, like, I'm happy to do all of it. I mean, I'd rather go dig on the pump track in my backyard a lot of times than dig in a professional setting. It's really much different. It's funny, we've got a number of, I've worked with a ton of great guys, and one of my best guys that I've ever worked with on any project is Morgan Benbow, and he's from Ashland, Oregon, and he's great at managing people. And he also realizes that my greatest strength, like, I can totally jump in our excavator and go build something, but he's like, no Boston machine today. All right. We have to get some stuff done. And like, for me, it's like, you have to allow someone else to do something so that you can do what you're best at and they can do what they're best at. And I think a lot of trail builders really get into the artwork of it. And they're so in, you know, kind of in love with their own creative process that everything else is kind of an infringement into that.
Sure.
And I guess I sort of remove myself from that 99% of the time. And it's more about, how can I help you to get the job done? So I wouldn't even, yeah, I mean, I would feel very sheepish to even call myself a trail builder. Like, I run a small business. But the reality is, I'm not an owner operator. Mm-hmm. Like, if I bid something, I'm going to go find the best guys to be in the machines. Yeah. I'm unlikely to be in a machine myself.
Okay. Yeah. That was one of my questions is, all right, I want to come work with Alpine Bike Parks as a trail builder. What do you want from me? Like, what are you looking for?
Hard work, on time, good communication, polite, and you know how to ride a bike and you love riding bikes. And, you know, thinking about how someone else is going to experience what you build is really important. So you have to be okay with, you can't expect to build something for yourself. You're building for someone else at a different skill level. So when you test ride that lip, you have to be thinking, okay, sure, it didn't buck me, but...
Is it bucking the first time jumper or
whatever? Yeah. How is it going to affect someone that doesn't have my skill set?
Yeah.
And, you know, generally the guys with the best flow, who can create the best flow, are going to be able to really know how to build that as well. And so there is an inherent connection between the more natural you are on a bike and the more you love doing it, the better you're going to be able to build, in my opinion.
For any level of rider.
For any level. But yeah, then you got to think about, what is it like for someone else?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, sure, you can no break that, but everybody else gets bucked, right? And
yeah.
And I'm fine with building stuff that is extremely challenging, as long as we make the user, help to educate the user so they know what risk they're taking on. If it's a surprise, then we've done something incorrect.
Interesting. Is it hard to find people to build like this?
Yeah, generally it's, you know, the toughest thing is the scheduling, because one thing we don't control is when we can start. And so, like, I was just talking to Kyle Jameson today about totally unrelated stuff. He's like, I heard you got approved at city council. And it's like, well, yeah, we got approved at city council to have another meeting. And so, I mean, this year we've been delayed in 3-week increments since June 7th. And so it's really challenging to know when guys are available and to help them to set their schedule.
Yeah. Cause if Kyle's like waiting on this job, it's like, oh,
right.
In the fall, I'll be able to go.
Yeah.
Work. Cause maybe not. Right.
Maybe not. Yeah. So that is a tough part of any development. And I think whether you're developing a high rise or an industrial facility or a bike park, the entitlements process to get access to the property and the approval process for the construction documents, that's, it can be very easy or it can be very complex.
Yeah. What, using Valmont or Ruby Hill or something like kind of your more current sort of showcase projects, is that fair to say?
Yeah.
I mean, what are some kind of hidden obstacles or things that people might not understand? Like, oh, Ruby Hill's approved, let's go. Are there, you know, just with like so we terrain, got, dirt, materials, equipment, all that stuff? Like,
well, when with Ruby Hill, we started there. We got about 6 days of work in, and what we were told as a subcontractor was, you hit any trash, this is an old dump, hit any trash, give us a call and we'll come take care of it. Mm-hmm. And so hit some trash, gave him a call. We found out that the city, who's the owner of the project, had failed to notify the Department of Environmental Health from the state that we were building in an asbestos area.
Okay.
So all of a sudden the project gets shut down. All the equipment gets cleaned off. We've got a delay from early August through like middle of December, I think, where they're cutting by hand in hazmat suits, 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot cubes anywhere. So we'd stripped 7 acres. We'd stripped a whole cross country trail network anywhere. We disturbed the land anywhere that they saw a Coors pull tab can from 1976 or a piece of broken glass or anything else.
It's searching for asbestos, basically.
Searching for anything that could be friable asbestos.
Okay.
And so that process, basically, so at that point, you're on the ground, you've rented a house, you've got all your equipment on the ground, you've told everybody that we're here to work. Yeah. They've come in from all over the country to run machines, and now we're stopping work. And you have no idea how long it's going to take to get going again. So that's... Yeah, it is the it's the coordination between different agencies that is often the toughest part.
Yeah, so is that a lesson where you're like, okay, now going forward, I'm going to make sure everyone's talking, or is that kind of out of your control?
The thing is that you don't have all that information.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you can't just call Colorado and be like, hey, did you talk to Denver to make sure?
You don't know that needed to be done.
Yeah.
Because you're not on that level. So, I think that's a lot. I mean, that's why a lot of people just decide to be owner operators, because you don't want to get involved with that. So, I mean, in essence, Alpine Bike Parks is a general contractor that provides the resources for builders to come together and build great stuff.
Okay.
And so, it's super frustrating and it bums me out when we're not able to give our builders consistency in employment or a start date that's really a start date. Right. You know, it's tough.
But it's all out of your control because of the bureaucracy. Yeah. It's crazy.
It's pretty square. Like, my job is, I mean, it's...
Dude, it kind of sounds like the least fun job out of the whole gig. You know what I mean? Like, I'm being
Build
bike parks.
I like winning, and so it makes it fun to win.
Yeah.
To basically, it's like each meeting, each vote, each little negotiation is like a little test, and I like getting A's on tests. So,
while I'm like, it sounds like the least fun, it sounds like it's also the most fulfilling. Like, you've got the long game in mind, and when it works out, it seems like
it's gotta be
pretty fulfilling.
Yeah. Yeah, my kids are proud of me. They really like it that I build parks, and that makes me feel good about it. They think it would be cooler if I was actually in the equipment. They've said that very clearly that I mean, Landon's like, I think it'd be a lot cooler if you ran the excavator. So
you're like, I do too. How do you handle feedback on a park that's done? Like, do you hear it from all sides? Like, oh, should have done this, should have done that. Does it just kind of roll off anymore?
You know, I'm not on social media. That's probably the most challenging place for people to give feedback. I'm totally open to people giving feedback. It is one of the toughest things. You know, if you think about how long it took the crew to develop Post Office to the point where
it was to
where it got to, and yep. to dial in each and every lip and landing. And so we're expected to create like 10 years of evolution.
Yeah, first try.
In, yeah, so I think criticism is totally acceptable. I mean, we're going to get criticism. It's never over. What we try and do to set facilities up for success is to create an adaptive management strategy for the city so that when we turn it over to them, mayor comes out, cuts the ribbon, they have a way to adapt to continue improving on flow. Hmm. It is not always that easy, though. If there's a way that we can, you know, one place where criticism was totally due, and I'm not the work. So IMBA sent me to Park City, Utah. Mm-hmm. One man army. I've got a 420D backhoe, bunch of rock and glass and dirt. And it's like, okay, this is going to be tough. I'm sleeping at one of the coordinator and volunteer's house. And, you know, it's like, how long is this going to take? Like, I don't know, a week or two? Or so then it becomes this pretty drawn out process where, and the equipment is donated, and so we can only use it on certain days. And then they'd be like, hey, we got to come pick that up. And all of a sudden the equipment's gone, et cetera. So in addition to that, I could have really used somebody there with a better eye and more experience building fun jumps. Hmm. I would have loved to have had it. Mm-hmm. The best thing we did there that I'm very proud of. And so all the criticism of that first round of work on those trails mm-hmm. is totally accepted. I wish it were better. Hmm. The best thing we did, though, is they were going to hire 2 part-time positions for guys from the union to
maintain.
Mow the grass, empty the trash cans, maintain the trails. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we got them to call it specialty work. We were able to hire 2 part-time guys who loved riding bikes mm-hmm. to basically help manage and be the eyes and ears and the maintenance team on the ground there. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's something that we can be proud of. And that place is, you know, like a layer cake. The way it should be, it's developed over time, and mm-hmm. it's an awesome spot now. It's not that Emmett built an awesome spot. It's not that I built an awesome spot, but we built a process so that that could continue to evolve over time.
Yeah.
And hopefully that's the best way to address criticism, is keep making it better and help set something up so that people can continue to improve it.
Yep. Yeah, that's cool. That seems like it would be a massive challenge too.
I'm super sensitive. Mm-hmm. So criticism for me is like, I take it very personally.
Yeah.
And I would say that that's a weakness. And so I just kind of, it's like, I accept it, but I shut it out a bit as well. Yep. 'Cause frankly, I mean, there's some guys that I think, you know, they just really don't care. I care way too much. Mm. And so yeah, criticism's tough, and at the same time, you know, fair enough. Like, yeah. Not everything's perfect.
Yeah. All right. So you worked at IMBA. Like, I'm not super in tune with what's happening right now, but I kind of feel like the go-to for IMBA is to just complain that they're making sidewalks. Do you want to shed any light onto what's going on?
I don't follow it, but it affects our business. Generally, there's a whole lot of small trail building companies out there. And none of them have very much sort of market. They're not market makers. They bid on things. They make friends. They sign contracts. They go out and they do work. You're either on Imba's team or you're not on Imba's team.
Okay.
Imba runs a ton of funding. And a few years ago, I mean, it seemed like we got blackballed. And so it's a challenging competitive environment. I personally feel that Imba's involvement in trail building is super anti-competitive. It is against their original ethos of helping communities to, well, you know, maybe they were never in favor of small companies building trails. That might never have been part of their ethos. But certainly, if you're on the team, you know you're on the team. Most people aren't. Most people are a bit shut out of their inside network. I think there's so many people working in different programs in that organization that they often don't know what the impact of their organization as a whole is. Everyone's so focused on their own little part of it that they don't realize that the outcome of a construction project is not that great. Or the impact of a reroute on trails makes it really lame. Or, you know, there's a number of externalities from Imba's partnerships and other decisions and strategies that, you know, I think we can do without. It's funny, I live in Whistler. I am so amazed by what the trail builders in Whistler have put together. I would say I've lived in Whistler for 8 years. I've been in and out of town for over a decade. I'm definitely a newcomer. I would not call myself a trail builder in Whistler. I have friends that are, and like, it's something you live. It's not something you do. And they've done a great job of keeping Imba out of Whistler. And I really appreciate that because we have our own culture and we have our own way of doing things. And I think that's awesome that there's places that are able to figure it out on their own.
Mm-hmm. Something like Bellingham's a similar situation. Like they're all running it.
Well, you know, there's lots of different ways to do it right.
Yeah.
And as a small contractor who has been kind of removed from Imba's team, I'd really prefer not to to have to compete with a company that has government funding, corporate funding, is able to donate services where we have to bid. They'll donate from one side, provide free services on the other side. There's no way we can compete with that.
Yeah, for sure.
We actually have to feed our family. So that sort of those different programs, how they work together and how they can provide grants to the same agency that is hiring people. And it's like, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That's a really tough thing to deal with as a small business person.
Ugh, I bet. You know, you're kind of talking about Whistler and what's going on. What do you think about rogue trail building?
I don't really think we have rogue trail building in Whistler. I think we have a lot of people that we have a different culture and a different perspective on it. Okay. Generally, a trail like Dark Crystal at first, I don't know if it was ever rogue, but
it's technically not legal, right?
Now it is.
Not sanctioned. Well, yeah, it is now. So
yeah. It's a great process. Not everywhere can do that, but, you can choose to live in a place that does work like that. It's certainly not that simple. It is less, you know, one of the biggest things that, we've been dealing with the project here in Boise is community engagement and how much community engagement was involved and required how much notification is required. There are a lot of places that decide to just get stuff done with a little bit less paperwork. Mm-hmm. And that said, that's not the best solution for every community. Sometimes it's better to go through a more straightforward process.
Sure.
But as far as Rogue Trailblazing and Whistler, sometimes I get the opportunity to ride new trails and they're private. And then after a while, they're not private anymore. And compared to Boulder, yeah, that's right. A very different way of dealing with that.
Yeah.
It's, and part of our management strategies, we suggest if a social trail is built to cut off a corner, instead of blocking that off, consider building a berm on the new social trail to actually further enhance that. There's a reason that the community has decided to cut that corner. It didn't have good flow. It wasn't where it was supposed to be. That's okay. We don't necessarily need to keep it just because it's there.
Mm-hmm.
We can always make it better.
Yeah.
So in the same perspective on a bigger picture scale, Boulder is very much against community built trails outside of their process. Whistler is quite open to community trails built outside the process. It's just that they might need to be amended before they can be opened. They may need some environmental improvements. They may need some hardening, etc. Whistler is blessed with amazing topography and dirt that's kind of hydrophobic, so it does not absorb water very much. And generally, the soils there are non-erosive. And so it's a great place to be a trail builder, I imagine, because you have this great canvas to go express yourself on.
Yeah. E-bikes and access, thoughts, opinions?
I've never been on one.
Do you feel like it could jeopardize what you do?
No.
Okay.
Uh-uh. I don't think that it does. I've got a blown ACL right now, and I've got to go to Rampage this week because I want to take my kids to Rampage. I'd love to have an e-bike to ride up the road to Rampage. I think in some places it makes a lot of sense. I'll be able to pedal a little bit, but I know if I'm blown out and my leg's throbbing, then I can still get back to the truck. I guess I definitely see him more as, it's tough when tourists on the Valley Trail in Whistler are on e-bikes and we're walking our dogs going to the lake. It's tough. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get run over by a tourist on an e-bike.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly you're putting somebody on, basically a CRF50 with big wheels when they don't know where the brakes are, that's just sort of a common sense, like starting point for where we could have problems.
Yeah.
In the US it's a way bigger deal than everywhere else.
Okay.
It's not, I just don't think it's that big a deal, but really I don't pay attention to it either.
Okay, cool. All right. Did you watch the Transition 6 Types of Trail Builder video?
Ooh, no, I didn't.
Okay, it's pretty funny. I was just going to ask if you were one of them, you should watch it. It'd be funny.
Yeah, is there a square guy that does paperwork and tries to get the best team together?
Dude, there isn't.
So I'm not a trail builder then.
All right, two more questions. When was the last time you had a shovel in your hand?
Last week. Yeah, at home. Yeah, we've got a pretty rad little pump track in our backyard. So I was out there whittling.
All right.
Yeah.
Sick. You ready for the project question now? Pick one. We don't even have to ask it if you don't want to.
No, that's all right. No, that's a good one.
Do you have a favorite? Like maybe that's one that means the most to you, start to finish?
Yeah, Valmont means the most to me, start to finish. It's funny, we won the design and then we won the construction. That was tough. And
does it not usually work that way? You get one or the other?
You never know, man.
Really? Okay.
You never know.
I just figured it was both, but it's not that
way.
No.
Design build projects are nice. The one here in Boise is design build. Yeah. And so that way you know that you're going to be able to actually 90% of the design is not on paper. Yeah. You have to put a ton of work into the paper, but then really what makes it flow is how a good builder interprets the design and puts it on the ground. And whether they have the flexibility in their construction budget and their timing to actually get it right and change it. So I guess the project that means the most to me is Valmont, just because we really set a different trend there. That was a project where, you know, we had public slope style trails. We had multiple pump tracks. You know, looking back on it now, I mean, it hasn't evolved very much. I would love to be able to bring it up to what's going on today. And I think that would be good for it. But generally, yeah, still proud of that for sure.
Cool.
You know, I guess the project that I think is the best one to go visit is the Stevie Smith Bike Park.
Yeah.
And, we were able to work with a number of guys on that. And it's just, you know, to be able to be part of that legacy in some small way is really valuable. And thinking about, you know, how with my kids being born on Vancouver Island and looking up to Stevie as much as they did,
yeah,
like, that's probably the best one to go check out.
Dude, that's so sick. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. All right, last one. And you may have just answered it with what you said, but dream project, no budget, couple people. Where would you go and what would you build?
So I would definitely either create, either purchase, you know, get a limited partnership together and purchase a ski area at low elevation, or find private land in a county where we can work really closely with the county government to install chairlifts and develop a low elevation, meaning, you know, we might have high vertical on the property, but generally it'd be year round project.
Sure.
I think that, you know, where I grew up in California, I would love to partner with, someone like Georgia Pacific or the Fisher family who owns the Gap and Mendocino Redwood Company or other major land holders who already have property. They have foundations associated with that, and really create a destination mountain bike center that that changes the economy of the region and create something where, you know, we have in rural areas, there's a lot of sort of re-ruralization where kids are leaving rural areas where they grew up. There's nothing really to hold them there. And so I'd love to create something that, where kids want to come back, there's great jobs for them, and it creates something that they can be passionate about and actually work in the industry and bring interesting people to a region like that. Yeah. You know, growing up in Mendocino, we're always like, why don't we get cool tourists here? Like, if there was even one tourist that we could like relate to, it'd be amazing. Yeah. And so I think mountain bike tourism is a really positive thing for a community to embrace and use as a tool for economic development. So yeah, that's basically, it would be large acreage, large elevation where we have control over, you know, everything from the capital expense forecast to the operations forecast. We're able to run patrol. We're able to run food and beverage. We're able to run all the operations aspects of it and have a long-term location where we could keep evolving trail construction and operations.
Dude, Is it going to happen?
Yeah, I bet it will.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Dude, that would be pretty cool. Yeah. Wait to see it.
Right on. Weird. Look forward to it.
2020, it'll be done.
Yeah, right.
Cool. Thanks, Chad. Yeah.
Hey, man.
Appreciate you coming out. Appreciate all your hard work and all the, especially the papers you push to put it your way. Like, it's, that does not sound easy. And I know tons of people get enjoyment out of what you help make. So thanks, dude.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks very much.
AlpineBikeParks.com. Alpine Bike Parks on Instagram. Whatever.
Probably. I don't know. somebody might be updating it.
Sweet. Hey, wait, real quick. Is your knee stiff?
Nah, it's all right.
Tell me the story you told me about Crab Apple just a few minutes ago and your kids.
Well, so my son Landon is 9. My son. All right. So my son Benny is 11 and his little brother Landon is 9. And so Chrissy and I, we bought a house in Whistler that's within riding distance of the bike park back in 2010. And so the kids have been growing up being able to ride their bikes to the bike park. Landon started riding the park when he was 3, and Benny probably when he was, around the same age. So I mean, they know the lifties, they know the mechanics, they like
as plugged in as you can get.
Right? Yeah, it's like it's their happy place where they're just totally comfortable. It's funny, we'll go to Woodward and they get all shy. But like in Skier Plaza there at Whistler, it's just that's life. And so yeah, I haven't hit Crab Apple for a couple years, but this year they've been out riding with Chris Kavarik and quite a bit. And so they started working their way through the set, and Landon started. So he's getting all the way through Crab Apple hits,
and he's like, 9.
Yeah, he's 9, and and Benny and I were like, "Whoa, we better like get our game together here because this is, you know, we can't let this get away from us." So then Benny and I are working our way through the set, and we had the goal that we just wanted to get like 5 laps through by the end of the season, and so. Yeah, I definitely got that. I think Benny got close.
Yeah.
But it's amazing watching them grow up with the resources we didn't have when we were kids. And I'm proud of helping them to live in that culture where mountain biking is not only okay, but absolutely celebrated.
Yeah. Cool. Good work. 9-year-old pushing you through Crab Apple. Love it.
So, yeah, it's funny. I haven't raced for years. And they always ask me to hit the Wednesday night races. Mm-hmm. And I'm always like, no. So they have a fat papa's class in the fat kids races. And so then my wife and I went and did Trans BC this year to just have like a week-long date basically with our friends. And so I came back from that and they're like, "Well, great. You're going to race Wednesday night now." And I was like, no, I don't race. And they're like, "You just raced 27 downhill races in a week. Like you're definitely racing." And so it made me think about like, it's cool that, I'm going to know when they get faster than me and I'm going to be able, it's going to be nice to like be aware of that moment because now we do race against each other every other Wednesday and it's,
are you still winning?
I'm still winning, yeah. But, yeah, they're getting close. Yeah, one was only like 1.5 seconds or something off. It's like really, really...
Dude, that's close.
Yeah, it's really close.
Thanks for tuning in to Vital MTB's The Inside Line Podcast. Episodes drop every other Wednesday. Thanks to Jensen USA and Maxxis Tires for the support. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at VitalMTB.